This is Flight Training the Way I See It with Mike Schiffer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode, the June 2024 podcast of Flight Training the Way I See It with your host, that's me, Mike Shiflett, and we're in Miami Beach. A couple things we're going to cover today. We're going to cover the TSA new rules, and there's new rules for the better for most of us. Going to talk about me speaking on the Facebook CFI study group on July the 2nd. I have that to talk about what I'm going to go over there. During that meeting, we're going to talk about energy management. Finally, someone's going to do this. I mean, we're going to take that 18 pages in the airplane flying handbook and trim it down. We're going to trim it down into what pilots really need to know to manage the energy of an airplane. We'll do that in three parts. So that'll be fun to do. And I think you'll be able to process that information a lot better than it currently is being presented in the handbook. There's a history of that as well. So the history is not a good history. Basically, that thing was 80-some pages when they first started it, and they said, okay, we got to trim this down. They got it down to about, it might have been 80 pages, but it was long, and they got to trim it down. So that was that. So anyway, there's that. We got some pro tips for you today, so that's what we're going to cover. Okay, let's look at some of the TSA new rules for the better. So TSA revamped the training rules for foreign pilots in May of 2024, and here's a summary. I've made a short summary. And by the way, you can get a physical copy, a PDF copy of the newsletter by going to our website and subscribing. Then you'll get that every month. So if you want a hard copy sort of in PDF form, you'll be able to get that. So CFIbootcamp.com. Also, while you're there, if you don't join the Power, if you're not part of that group, join that because that's a one-hour live sort of deep dive into some aviation topic that we do every Saturday from noon until 1 Eastern time. This one coming up will be Power Hour 190. We'll do 190. We're counting down to 200, which you're going to get to in September. Okay, so enough about that. And then the way you can get to that, I should say, there's a title bar. If you go to the homepage, there's a bar appears across the top, and it basically has you click it. You go to that place, and then you'll be able to get on the Power Hour list, and you'll get a link and all that stuff. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything, so do that. Okay, let's look at the TSA. There's five things here I want to go with you. The first is TSA approval is now valid for 5 years. And the student can do multiple ratings without further TSA approval. And switching training providers or instructors is now permitted without repeating this process. So that's a really big thing. That's a really nice thing to have done there. Number two, some alternate methods to TSA approval. If you have TSA PreCheck, Global Entry can be used instead of going through the TSA approval process. The process is in the rules, but TSA needs to be notified of PreCheck or Global Entry upon application. So that can make things go a lot quicker. Number three, demo flights are now clearly defined as being okay to do before TSA approval. That single flight you're allowed to do is now in part of the regulation there. It's been defined. Number four, TSA security awareness training now has to be completed every 2 years rather than every year. Hallelujah. So now we only have to do that online course every 2 years. And number five, a safety coordinator must be named. This person is a point of contact for all TSA matters. So if you're a 61 instructor, that person is you. They mentioned that they need to have 24/7 access. So we need to learn a little bit more about that over the next few weeks to discover, you know, how we're going to be able to comply with that. But I think there'll be a easy enough way to comply with it. So there's that. All right, moving on. Let's go on to the next thing. So join me on July the 2nd from 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time or 7 to 9 Eastern time, and I'm going to be on the CFI study group. It's a Facebook group, and you can get there by going to Facebook and signing up for the CFI study group. And that's Dorothy Schick and company, and they've got about 6,000 members, and there's plenty of really good posts and questions for CFIs in training, or even CFIs that just have questions about things that are currently working. There's really good people in there. Like, there's Greg Brown, author of The Savvy Flight Instructor. Then there's Rod Machado, which most people know, and a slew of DPEs in there like Jim Pittman and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of people. So Dorothy is the admin, one of them, and she's a flight instructor with a lot of experience. And then Rex Scholl is the administrator of the group as well. and he's a busy CFI in Utah. He also helps out at CFI Bootcamp by critiquing lessons that students present. He's in Utah, and he zooms in and helps out with the class. So he's usually part of our class. He's also very good at what he does. So every Tuesday, this group has a two-hour Zoom call, and there's usually a speaker for an hour, not always, and then questions for the group. So if you have particular questions you want answers to or just advice, that's a great place to go. I'm going to speak on how to manage training studying for your flight instructor certificate, what works and what doesn't. This is going to be on July 2nd, and it's going to be 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So to get the link for the Zoom meeting, you need to go to the CFI Study Group on Facebook and join. It's free, and the approval probably takes like about a day because Dorothy or Rex has to go through them all. I think there's another admin currently, but anyway, maybe it'll be a little quicker than that, but around that. So don't do it the day of, and that'll get you the Zoom link. There's no real marketing going on in that group, so it's pretty clean. So I don't think you'd have any reason not to join it. So some of the things in particular I'm going to hit on during that meeting is how and what do I study when? How is the FOI tested and what do I need to know? I can't seem to get organized how to fix that problem. Is self-study right? Is self-study right for you? We just need to get a two-year CFI for the sign-off, right? So in order do I teach these lesson plans in anyway? So I find there's a really big disconnect between the check ride and then having to start working a job and knowing what to do. There's a really, shouldn't be any disconnect, but there is. You know, on one of the posts, one person said, when does teaching as a CFI click and for you? When did that click for you? And I'm like, well, the day I got my certificate or before I got my certificate would be the answer to that. I really am not entitled to that certificate unless I can teach. So it needs to click. But now, if the reason the question posted was when do you get better at it, that's different. But if it's like when does it just start to make sense for you? It needs to make sense before you get your certificate. This is not a license to learn. This is a license to teach. Okay, so this will be a good presentation for anybody currently training or considering becoming a flight instructor. So that's, again, going to be July the 2nd. 4 to 6 Pacific time. CFI Study Group is the name on Facebook group. And you'll know it's the right one because Dorothy Schick, Rex Scholl are administrators. Okay, now we're going to talk about energy management in a three-part series, making sense of that long-winded chapter in the Airplane Flying Handbook. So, whoever thought it was a good idea to teach energy management to a pilot by reading 18 pages of technical content really doesn't know pilots. We need to use information quickly, not analyze details. The chapter has good information, but it has one flaw like an opera. It's two-thirds too long, right? So my goal over the following few months is to prepare these articles and give you the basics of energy management that any pilot can understand using airplane examples and a bit of very, very rudimentary science, like physics, but really small. Well, don't worry. I'm only going to use enough to help you understand the concept. We're not going to take it any further than needed to understand a concept that we can use. Okay, so we're going to get started. I always like to inform people why they need to understand something and to what level. That provides motivation and the purpose of the lesson, so here it goes. We must understand energy management to control the airplane's movement from takeoff to touchdown. We must understand how the airplane will behave and how it can be controlled throughout this process. So that's a big sentence, but it says why we should bother with this. Okay, in this article, I'm going to talk about weight, the weight side of the equation. So there's three components we're going to talk about, but one is weight, and so we're going to come on that first. So if we take these in individual pieces, by the time the 3 months is done, you have a really good grasp of energy management. So all airplanes have weight, and their design characteristics are optimized for various missions, like training, transport, aerobatics, whatever it might be. And all airplanes use some kind of energy, like avgas, electricity, jet A. So depending on how heavy an airplane is, how it is designed, and how much energy it has, we need to understand how we can control its movements and supply or dissipate energy so that we can land at an acceptable speed. So, I mean, we can take an airplane out of control, and if we want to point it straight down to the ground, you know, and say, I think we'll land off that, you'll soon see that won't work because you can't control the energy. It's just dissipating rapidly and you can't control the speed. So we don't want that. So we have to manage the airplane's movement through the air, its flight path, in such a way that we can always manage its speed, right? So let's talk about that. An airplane has weight and it must overcome it by producing lift. Great, that's easy, right? Airplanes are flying under the influence of gravity, so when they can no longer produce lift, they automatically return to the ground, right? So if you can't generate lift either by speed or by angle of attack, and you can't put more energy into the motor because you're out of gas, you're going to go down towards the ground. Now, the heavier the airplane, the more momentum it has when it's moving. This means that it resists any change to the flight path. This is Newton's second law, which I'll describe to you. So basically what it means is when an airplane's moving, it typically, anything's moving, it has mass, it wants to stay in the direction it's moving and at the same speed. It doesn't want to change that if it can help it. And so the acceleration of an object depends on the mass of the object and the amount of force applied. So we get to talk a little bit about that. We talk about what acceleration is. It's not just speeding up or slowing down. It's not just speeding up. Okay, acceleration occurs with a change of speed, going faster or slower, or a change in direction. So, for example, an airplane that's turning is being constantly accelerated. There's a force being exerted on the airplane at all times. So changing the flight path of an airplane, like causing a climb, is also an acceleration on the airplane because its direction is changing. The same if it's turning. So what does this mean to us? So think about a super heavy airplane like a Boeing 777. This thing weighs a lot, right? It weighs a lot. And all is well, so it's heading towards the ground on the ILS on a 3-degree glide path. But the pilot then maybe needs to execute a go-around or a missed approach. Then the airplane's momentum is in the way of immediately allowing the pilot to change the flight path. You can pitch up if you want, do all this that you want, but the airplane's still going to head towards the ground until the momentum of the airplane changes, right? Well, not changes, but the airplane has momentum, so it's going to want to continue towards the ground. Eventually, the flight path will be modified over some time. So the only thing the pilot can do is add power and not hit the critical angle of attack of the wing. However long it takes to get the airplane from descending to back to a climb is a function of its weight, right? Momentum, how much energy we can put back into the system, right? We talk about energy on a different podcast, but in general, we're talking about the weight now. So if you think about something like a fly, you ever seen these flies in your house and they sort of hover, they go one way and they instantly like turn left. And as soon as they decide to go left, they go left. There's no time. You can't do that in a car or an airplane because you have momentum, you have weight. So you can't just instantly change your direction, right? You think about a pilot who's an aerobatic pilot. And let's say they mess up the loop. This would be a bad outcome. But so they stick up for the loop, and they didn't check the altimeter well enough. And it's going to be too low, right? They're going to hit the ground. So come across the top of the loop, you could still save it. Then you come down on the down line. Now you don't have a choice. So now what you got to do is you got to be able to modify the airplane's flight path in such a way that you don't exceed the critical angle of attack, and you change the flight path before you hit the ground to something level or a climb. So the heavier the airplane is, the longer that's going to take. So momentum affects the airplane through all axes, roll, pitch, and yaw. The heavier it is, the more time it takes to change the flight path. Okay, so that's what we need to talk about, weight. We need to overcome weight to fly, and we need to manage how this airplane is going to behave. And depending on the airplane, they'll all behave differently depending upon what they're optimized to do. So we'll talk a little bit about that as the months go on. But in general, think about weight. Nothing we can do about that. We have a certain amount of weight that we have to put in the airplane. And it weighs a certain amount. And so we got to manage the energy. Sometimes we have devices that help us manage that energy, that can cause us to slow down quicker, can change the airfoil shape a little bit, any of those kind of things. But we have to manage the flight path of the airplane in such a way that we also can manage the airspeed, so we can take off and land. Okay, next month we're going to discuss energy and its states, particularly kinetic and potential energy. And we'll combine our knowledge of weight, momentum, and acceleration with energy, and some light bulbs might just go on. There you go. Okay, let's finish off with some pro tips. Yay, these are pretty good, I think. There's two or three of them. Let's take a look. Three of them. So the first pro tip is how to perform the loss of engine on takeoff roll prior to 50% of the VMC speed in a multi-engine airplane. So that's a requirement that is trained and tested. So you have to fail the engine, one of the engines, prior to 50% of the VMC speed, and then the applicant student has to be able to recover, keep the airplane under control. So, but as an MEI, this can be a kind of a dangerous situation for you, because if the student doesn't react in time, the airplane can go off the runway, right? And can lose control of it. So during the takeoff roll, right after the airplane begins to move, fail an engine using the mixture control. So by using the mixture, this allows a student to keep their hands on the throttles, which is a primacy issue. You want their hands to be on the throttles. Now the trick here is to begin moving the other mixture control back right after you fail the other engine, so it's on its way to shut off. So if the student is too slow or unresponsive, the other engine is going to fail too, right? Then you won't have any issue with controllability. So then make sure, though, that you coordinate the extra time you need with the tower, because if you shut both engines off and you have to start them back up again, it may take some measure of time, and you need to let the controller know that, or let wherever you're training at know that. Maybe other pilots, or it might not be the best idea to do at a non-towered airport. You might have to, but because you can't, sometimes there'll be airplanes there with no radios. So you've got that. Anyway, that's for you to deal with on that one. Okay, number two is teaching the roundout in a training airplane. Where do I start? So the roundout is where you begin to stop the airplane's momentum from going from a descent to level flight for briefly, and then into the roundout, the landing flare, to dissipate the rest of the speed. It's called the roundout, okay? So where do you start? In most training airplanes, the roundout begins when you can clearly see the tire marks on the runway. So it's also the point where the look of the runway changes. So this, let's see if we can kind of play with this for a second. But when you're at a higher altitude, like several hundred feet or 1,000 feet, as you descend, it looks like you're going down towards the ground. It has that look, right? It's like, oh, it looks like I'm descending. But when you get close to the ground, within 10, 20 feet, something like that, it all of a sudden the ground looks like it's rushing up to meet you, right? It kind of changes. It doesn't. Yeah, it looks like you're going to the ground, but also the ground begins rising quickly. It's like blossoming in the windscreen. So like when you are about ready to hit somebody in a mid-air collision, just all of a sudden, you know, the thing just blossoms, gets huge in the windscreen very quickly, right? It's the same thing when you get near the ground, when you get closer to objects. So that is the point where you start the roundout. When you start seeing the runway rush up towards you, that's the point to start the roundout. Clearly you see the tire marks, that's one thing. Make sure you can clearly see them. And at about that same point, you're going to see the ground start rushing up. At that point, you change your eyes, your focus, to where you're looking. So you look down the runway. You don't look at the point where you're landing at anymore, because it'll just get all blurry, right? So you look at a speed that's commensurate to what you'd be driving. So if you're driving 70 miles an hour or so, you think about how far ahead you're looking. That's about how far you're going to look ahead in an airplane to judge its rate of descent. So you want to see the settling rate of the airplane to the runway and be able to control that. Now, third tip of the day is do not fly traffic patterns by landmarks. Don't fly traffic patterns on landmarks when to do things. So, okay, you fly to that house, that guy's house right there, and you turn, that's a crosswind. Then you fly downwind, and then you'll wait till you get to here on the base turn. That's Google over here. So you're going to turn over that. No, don't do that, because that only works for that kind of airplane. So if you take a bigger airplane, a smaller airplane, those points will be different, right? And if you practice the power of 180 using landmarks over the ground, you won't develop the skill to do it in any other airplane or any other airport. So don't use ground-based references to define the base turn, crosswind, etc. Manage the airplane's energy while controlling wind drift. This is the goal of any landing and in teaching any pilot. One of the things I found most fascinating when I was a pilot examiner is these ground reference maneuvers. So I would take people out, we would test them on a ground reference maneuver, like turns around a point, it would be fine. S turns across the road, it would be fine. We'd go back to the traffic pattern, what would happen? They would drift in the pattern. I'm like, what? On the base turn, we're like drifting like crazy because the wind is strong. I'm like, why are we drifting? What was the whole purpose of the ground reference maneuver? To learn them, just to make some pattern across the ground? No, it was to stop wind drift. So when you start corrupting teaching, like you start, like there's a person I used to work with. So you know his podcast. Anyway, he has he shows you a way to do lazy eights. And you wouldn't need to read the airplane flying handbook to be able to do it. But is it really teaching the right message is what I want to know. Could we just, if we want to do it in that method, could we just not just put the title Lazy 8 and just make a statement, one simple statement about it, and say that's all we ever need to know about it. Just do this and it will always work. Well, I don't know if it'll do it in every airplane, but I tend to want to teach people to fly in such a way that they can use this knowledge to fly other things or to understand, you know, to develop proficiency or coordination or something in that pilot. There's a reason I'm doing something. I have to have a good reason to tell the student. So if I'm practicing powerful 180s in a particular airplane, I want the techniques that which I'm giving the student to work, right, for other aircraft. That, of course, like in the aero, you might have to turn right away if it's a short stubby wing aero. If it's a 172, you got quite a bit of time. So, but the principles there don't change. And I didn't use any landmarks across the ground, or I didn't say count to five. I didn't say any of that stuff that doesn't make any sense, right? So teach from the airplane flying handbook. Life hacks are fine for like getting a stain out of your shirt, but not for flying. Okay, let's not do that. Okay, that's all I got for you this week. I encourage you to go to CFIbootcamp.com, sign up for the newsletter, for the paper copy, or I wouldn't say paper, the PDF copy of that, and then also for the Power Hour, which is every Saturday. And this Saturday we're doing, there'll be a review, so you probably see it as a review of the history of various maneuvers like chandelles, lazy eights, and steep spirals, how they did them back then, how we do them today, and what's changed, and why they're in the utility category. Why are lazy eights and chandelles in the utility category on a placard in a 172? Why would they be such a, it's not an aggressive maneuver, or was it? We'll see. So anyway, our next CFI class will be July the 8th. It'll be in Las Vegas, and it'll be there at North Las Vegas Airport. So if you're interested in attending that, do it. There is a double I class the following week. It'll be Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's remote. So there'll be no physical classroom for the double I class. And then after that, we have a class coming up in Opa-locka in Miami. That's going to be the following month. So it's going to be in August. And back to Palo Alto in September. So those of you waiting for various times to come around, that's it. You can also join remotely. Our camera technology is quite good. We use Owl Labs, and it's a great technology. If you were seeing a video of the classroom, you'd see the first quarter of the top of the screen would be the entire classroom. It would be a 360-degree view. And then whoever's talking, the owl will know, and it will pivot itself. It has electronic cameras, nothing physical, and it will center that person in the view. And if two people talk to each other, it'll make two panes down there, and you'll see them both talking, up to three people it would do. So it's quite an interesting technology. It makes the user experience, or your experience, remote experience, very good. Okay, that's it for this week, or this month, I should say, for another episode complete, the June issue of 2024 of Flight Training the Way I See It. This has been a production of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, tips, and opinion.